As most of you know, we're on a journey through the Bible. Last week, Pam took us through the book of Genesis, which ends with the story of Joseph and how the Israelites came to be in Egypt. Today, we pick up the storyline in Exodus, where Israel's fate has drastically changed. After Joseph and his generation died, the people of Israel found themselves for the first time in captivity. This is the one and only time I am aware of that the Israelites are in captivity through no fault of their own. In fact, God allowed Jacob and his family to come to Egypt to preserve their lives during the great famine Joseph had predicted. Jacob's family was given the best of the land, which was Goshen. It may have been easy to forget that this was meant to be but a temporary stay in Egypt. In Scripture, this stay is called a sojourn, suggesting its temporary nature. But when you're comfortable, who wants to think of moving? Perhaps that is one reason God allowed the Israelites, who have become very numerous by then, to be enslaved. He wanted to create a need and a longing in them to get away from the place he had not desired to be their permanent home. The Israelites were chafing in bondage when things got even worse. Pharaoh decreed that all the newborn Israelite boys must die. Satan's plan was evil, as only Satan can be, and almost succeeded, except that Jochebed would have none of it and attempted to save her then 3-month-old baby by committing him in a basket to the River Nile, the exact river that was to swallow up all the little boys. You'd think that Satan would have learned his lesson here, that he couldn't thwart God's plan, but he must have been familiar with the adage, if at first you don't succeed, try again. He tried the same unsuccessful tactic to destroy Jesus by destroying the infants in Bethlehem at the time of his birth. Interestingly, Jesus' family fled with him to Egypt, and they sojourned there for 2 years. But back to Moses. We're all familiar with the story of how the Egyptian princess saved him, and over time he became her adopted son. Moses lived a life of luxury while being schooled in the arts of leading people. He may have been groomed to be the next Pharaoh. In any case, he gained a first-class education that helped him later in his task. Yet, God knew that although this education was invaluable for his future task, there was also much Moses had to unlearn. Without going into detail, you may recall that early on in Moses' adult life, when he was in a great position of power over others, he had even killed an Egyptian. It's quite possible he may have thought that military prowess would carry the day in freeing the Israelites. For this reason, God led him into the wilderness of Midian to teach him a whole new way of living. And God accomplished that by giving Moses the job of taking care of dumb sheep. God used this humble job to teach him about patience, kindness, perseverance, humility, and most of all, utter reliance on him. In fact, when God called Moses at the burning bush, he had completely lost his self-reliance and didn't want the task of freeing Israel at all. Who actually was it that met Moses at the burning bush? Moses asked, "If the people should ask, who should I tell them sent me?" We can read the answer in Exodus 3, verse 14. "I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you." This is an interesting name. In the Old Testament, children were often given names that showed their character or some trait about them. Abraham and Sarah's name were changed from Abram, God is exalted, and Sarai, princess of a family, to reflect what was happening in their lives. Abraham means father of a multitude, and Sarah means princess of a multitude. Isaac means laughter, since Sarah laughed when she heard that she was going to be a mother in her old age. Jacob means supplanter, as Jacob stole the birthright from Esau. But I am who I am, and I am seems very vague. At the same time, though, it is absolutely beautiful. It implies someone who has always been, is now, and will always be. He is the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. It also suggests someone whose character is constant and unchangeable. He's not a fickle, capricious God like gods of human devising. He cannot be manipulated or misused for someone's own purposes. At the same time, it is a deeply personal name that suggests that he can be anything to anyone at any time of need as fits in his divine plan for every individual. We see this clearly when the Jews recognize that Jesus claims divinity. Jesus calls himself, "I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the vine." In God's name, as revealed at the bush, we see Jesus talking to Moses. He was to Moses what Moses needed him to be in God's divine plan, and he can be to us what we need him to be in God's understanding of our situation. Let's see what he was to the Israelites. In chapters 7 to 11 of Exodus, we see the plagues being poured out on Egypt that will lead to the Israelites' eventual freedom. Here, the I Am is the advocate for the Israelites. Again and again, He sends Moses to negotiate the release of the Israelites and works on their behalf. Egypt lies in ruins, and Pharaoh is finally ready to let the Israelites go. More than that, he begs them to go. In chapter 12, the I Am is the guardian of their firstborn. Through specific instructions, God shows the Israelites the way to life. These instructions that involve a spotless lamb and blood on the doorposts foreshadow what he will be and do on the cross to save each one of us in his eternal kingdom. He is the Lamb, and it is his blood that covers us and protects us from certain and eternal death. Later on in chapter 12, the I Am becomes the deliverer of his people. We often think of Moses as the deliverer, but Moses was only a tool in God's hands. In Exodus 12, verse 51, we read, "And on that very day, the Lord brought the Israelites out of Egypt by their divisions." In chapter 13, we see the I Am as guide to Israel. He tells them exactly where to go. Although their wanderings throughout Exodus may seem random, God leads them with purpose and reason. Bill touched on that briefly this morning in his opening remarks, exemplified in verse 17 of chapter 13. We see that the shortest route to Canaan would have led the Israelites through the land of the Philistines. But God knew that they couldn't face war at this time yet, and might even go back to Egypt if confronted with it. So he opts for a longer road. Although the Israelites thought they were leaving, ready for battle, as you can read in verse 18, God simply knew better. In chapter 14, we see a terrified Israel pursued by an angry Egyptian army. The army is closing in from behind, and the Red Sea is in front of them. They are trapped and don't know what to do. How right God was that they were not ready for battle. They show no confidence in either Moses or God, and just wished they had continued to endure their slavery in Egypt. But the great I Am goes to battle for them. He is their warrior. First, we see him act through the pillar of cloud and fire that has been with them since Sukkoth in Egypt. Don't you sometimes wish you had a pillar like that to show you exactly where to go, which way to take? This pillar enabled them to travel by day or by night. It protected them from the scorching sun and provided light in the darkness. At the Red Sea, this pillar that had always gone before them until now, moved behind them to be between them and the Israelites coming from behind. It was a dark cloud to the Egyptians in the night, preventing them from attack, but it provided light to the Israelites. Now, the I Am parted the waters of the Red Sea and allowed the Israelites to cross on dry foot. The pillar of cloud moved along with them so that the Egyptians were now able to go in hot pursuit into the parted waters where God caused them to get bogged down, and then for the water to close in again over the heads of the Egyptians and make good on his word through Moses in chapter 14, verses 13 and 14. Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. What a wonderful warrior God has been for the Israelites. The account concludes with the statement in verse 31 that the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant, and joyfully celebrated with song and dance. Sadly, the trust the Israelites had learned in this ordeal did not last. Again and again, when hardship came, the Israelites failed. They were complainers and whiners, sort of like us when trouble comes upon us. How often do we see God work on our behalf just to complain at the next turn? We see Moses, on direction of God, make bitter water sweet. God provides manna and quail when the Israelites go hungry. He tells Moses how to get water from a rock. In chapters 15 through 17, the I Am is the provider for his people. It's not that they are never hungry or thirsty. Oh, they are. But the I Am allows the extremity so that they can clearly see him at work and learn to trust him more. Unfortunately, they have short memories. Until now, God has kept the Israelites from the necessity of war. But in chapter 17, the time has finally come for their first battle against the Amalekites. Moses sends some of his men out to war, but he knows they cannot win without God. While Joshua leads the fight, Moses, Aaron, and Hur go up to the top of a hill to beseech God for the victory. And they find that while Moses holds up his arms to God, the Israelites are winning. But when his arms sink, the tide turns. So Aaron and Hur support Moses' arms until the battle is won. Moses then builds an altar to the Lord and recognizes the great I Am for what he has been to the Israelites in this fight, their banner. In chapter 18, we see the I Am as a counselor in the person of Jethro. Sometimes it is necessary to have counsel offered by other people when we can't see clearly. Moses is overworked as judge of the people and wears himself out. Thankfully, he listens to his father-in-law Jethro on how to make things easier on himself and more organized. It is amazing to see the humility of great Moses in accepting counsel. What a great example for us. Now we're coming up on chapter 20 in Exodus. I've been an Adventist for long enough to know that we Adventists can get really excited about Exodus chapter 20. The Ten Commandments. How exciting and holy and good, spoken by God Himself in awe-inspiring circumstances. And it's good to understand the Ten Commandments in the proper place God intended them for our lives. But let's read something that comes just a chapter before that, chapter 19. I think it is meant to be a preparation for what will come in Exodus chapter 20. Here we find the I Am becomes the sanctifier of His people. God, or shall we say, Jesus, says in chapter 19, verse 4, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." Have you ever fretted about challenging, how challenging it can be to come to God? Have you ever thought how useless it is to even try because again and again you fail in your efforts? Well, how did the Israelites come to God? Was it through their efforts, their goodness, their obedience? No. God, and I'll repeat, Jesus says, "I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." What beautiful imagery, and what a stupendous outcome. It is through His action that we have fellowship with Him. Our efforts are in vain, but His grace is sufficient. And in case you're not sure this is what God is trying to say, let's look at Jesus' own words during His earthly ministry in the New Testament, John 12, verse 32. "And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." And as we recognize that God's goal throughout all of human history has been to draw His beloved creation to Himself, we see in Exodus 20 that the I Am reveals Himself as the lawgiver. The reality is God's law has existed for all of eternity and can be summed up in just one word: love. But God's people in Exodus 20 weren't ready for the spiritual depth that this word implies. So God broke it down for them into 10 statements of how they would live their lives when they recognized Him for who He is. Jesus, thousands of years later during His earthly ministry, tried to lead people into the spiritual depths of His law of love by saying things like, "You have heard it said, you shall not murder. But I tell you, if you hate your brother, you are already guilty." And the reality is, in the big picture of His teachings, He goes even further to say that not hating someone isn't enough. A neutral stance towards someone isn't enough. We are called to love as Christ loved. I'm glad God started with something simple like the Ten Commandments, because the law of love is truly deep. But I'm also glad that he continues to draw me unto himself as he teaches me more and more about the true way of love. The Ten Commandments are given in chapter 20 of Exodus, followed by laws for all kinds of circumstances and events in chapters 21 to 23. The I Am cares about his people, and he cares for them. He does not leave them in chaos, but gives them an ordered life. When you look at this law, it isn't arbitrary, something to be kept just to make God happy. Rather, it is a law that recognizes that people will fail and provides a remedy for each situation to allow for an ordered continuation of life. In the end, God will provide the ultimate remedy in the death of Jesus Christ on the cross and his resurrection in glory. After God has given these commandments, he summons Moses up to meet with him at the mountaintop again. In chapters 24 to 31, Moses spends another 40 days there and receives explicit instructions in constructing a sanctuary. And if we had the time right now, which we don't, I could draw a picture for you about how even the sanctuary is all about God drawing us to himself. You see, this God, who calls himself the I Am, Jesus, is a lover. He loves his people so much that he wants to dwell with them and teach them the way of salvation through his sanctuary. In loving detail, he communicates his plan of ultimate redemption to the people of old. Sadly, what follows is the story of the golden calf in chapter 33. Within the 40 days Moses spends on the mountaintop with God, the people lose their faith and hope and demand of Aaron to make them another god. If it wasn't so sad, the story could be really quite comical. Verse 4 specifically says that Aaron cast the gold he had collected for this purpose in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. But later on, when brought to account by Moses, he tries to minimize what he has done by saying that he threw the gold in the fire, and would you believe it? Out came this calf. But here we see the I Am as both the guardian of freedom and a judge. He's the guardian of freedom because he allows people to make their choice for or against him. God does not force anyone to give allegiance to him. We are free to choose him or not. However, our choices have consequences, and as we see played out in the story of the golden calf, and as it will be played out in our story, as followers or despisers of God. After this event in chapter 33, Moses asks God to see his glory. What a bold request! Moses really is close to God, isn't he? God's answer is interesting. He reveals his name to Moses as the I Am of goodness, mercy, and compassion. That is his glory. While he is a glorious being whose face cannot be seen, his true glory is in these attributes. Our hearts should open wide to a God like this. The last chapters in Exodus tell us of how the sanctuary is put together. Of course, the sanctuary involved furniture that was highly symbolic and made by expert craftsmen. We don't have the time to delve into all that. More importantly yet, the sanctuary involved a priesthood, including a high priest, which was the bridge between Israel and God, ordained, set apart people whose job it was to atone for the sins of Israel. But for the great I Am, our true great high priest, who put all this into place, it was just a beginning point. See, even the priestly work in the sanctuary was too much separation for God with his people. God's desire has always been to be face to face with his people as it was in the beginning. But as we look at how the sanctuary theme develops through the Bible and into the New Testament, we see that the true great high priest is Jesus himself. And through his death on the cross, he allowed the curtain separating the holy and the most holy of the sanctuary to be torn in two, declaring, "I have accomplished what is necessary to put the separation between me and my creation to death." The story of that mediation that begins in Exodus and moves through the Gospels ends in Revelation with the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven and Jesus himself declaring, and I slightly paraphrase, "Look, my dwelling place is now among my people, and I will dwell with them. They are my people. And I, their God, am with them and will forever be their God." And that beautiful passage in Revelation 21 ends with these words, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." Today, we have seen many ways God's name, I Am, can show how he can be what we need. And just because the book is done, the many facets contained in the name, I Am, are not exhausted. Today, we have seen him as the advocate, the guardian, the deliverer, the guide, the warrior, the provider, the banner, the counselor, the sanctifier, the lawgiver, the lover, the guardian of freedom, the judge, goodness, mercy, compassion, and high priest. Add to that what we have seen him as in the New Testament, and we end up with a marvelous picture of God. This kind of God is trustworthy and dependable. He truly is the great I Am.